So let's look kind of at a roadmap. Let's talk about where we're going to go together in this work, our path for exploration. The first thing we're going to do is we're going to talk about exactly what is vulnerability and why is it essential for wholehearted living. We're going to talk about what drives our fear of being vulnerable. We're going to bust some huge vulnerability myths, like vulnerability is weakness. Number one myth, profoundly dangerous. We're going to talk about why it's dangerous and why it's not true. We're going to talk about how we're protecting ourselves from vulnerability. I call this the armory. Because what ends up happening for all of us is that we end up waking up in the morning and saying, I can't go out there and be vulnerable. So we put this armor on and we go out in the world and our take is kick ass, don't let yourself be seen, be strong, suck it up, soldier on. We get home, and this is what has really changed in the last 5 years. We get home, and you know how much work it is to put armor on? It's like Spanx, but worse. I mean, it's like, yeah, it's like a lot of work. So when we get home, we don't take it off because it's too much work. So what ends up happening, and I see this in families all the time, our partners don't see us. Our kids don't see us. We can't have that empathic exchange that we talked about because we're armored up at home too. So we're going to talk about what is the armor, why do we put it on, how do we get it off, and then we're going to go through, in the last sessions together, the 10 guideposts of wholehearted living. Does that make sense? Okay. I'm looking forward to doing this with y'all. We'll take a break, and then we'll be back. So thank y'all so much.
Our program continues with Session 2, Shame Triggers with Brené Brown.
So we left off with talking about kind of the path for exploration, where we're going to go over our six sessions. And we're going to talk about vulnerability first, then we're going to talk about the guidepost for wholeheartedness. But I left one out, which is pretty serious. We're going to start with what gets in the way. Do y'all think y'all are going to skate on that? Yeah. We're going to talk about shame gremlins and the hustle for worthiness. And here's why. I don't think we can really do the work we need to do around getting vulnerable and believing that we're enough until we talk about the shame gremlins and until we talk about the hustle. So gremlins, the term is from the horror comedy, Steven Spielberg's horror comedy from the 80s, Gremlins. And if you'll remember, the gremlins were these little creatures that were terrible looking and scary and just wreaked havoc wherever they went. And the reason I love that metaphor is, it's a great metaphor for the shame tapes, the stuff that plays through our mind. You know, in my circle of friends, we call it the gremlins. So if I were to call a friend and say, I cannot get this article written, it's due in 3 hours, I'm still on the first paragraph, my friend would say, what's the gremlin? And I'd say the gremlin is real writers don't struggle. Real writers don't dangle their modifiers. Real writers don't get stuck. You know, real writers, that kind of thing. Like I'm having the imposter gremlin is all over and I'm not really, and it's actually true. I don't think I write because it's necessity. I speak because I love it. But I can't go around everywhere, so I put my stuff in books, and I enjoy it sometimes, but writing's tough for me, and I have a lot of gremlins around writing. And so I like the word gremlin. The other reason I love it is because gremlins died when they got exposed to the light. And so I think that's exactly how shame works. And I'll tell you this, too. This will be the first time I've ever talked about this. It's new research. So that's a code for this could be a little awkward until I figure out how to say it. Because it's a little bit complicated, actually. I'm going to dip into some neurobiology, which, trust me, you're safe in my hands because I won't dip down too far. Really. I used to say, hey, are there any neurobiologists in the audience? And that's a really bad idea. Because then when there were like 5 or 6 hands would shoot up, I'd say, we're not going to be talking about that today. So the neurobiology of shame is really important, and I'm going to talk about it again in a minute, but I want to talk about some basics about gremlins and dementors. Dementors from Harry Potter. We're hardcore Harry Potter people in my house. And the Dementors is another great metaphor for shame, because they basically suck every ounce of lightness out of you until you're left feeling hopeless and nothing, like nothing's good in your life. And that's what shame does. The reason metaphors are so important for shame, first of all, we have a very visceral reaction to the word shame. People hear the word shame and they've got one or two responses. One, I have no idea what you're talking about and I'm pretty sure that happens to other people. Or two, I know exactly what that is and I'm not talking about it. We have a visceral reaction to the word shame. One of the things that's interesting is you've got the TEDx Houston talk, which is called The Power of Vulnerability. And then you have the recent TED talk from this year that's called Listening to Shame. And it's not at anywhere being shared at the same level as the first TED talk, even though a lot of people think that they liked it better. But the reason, and I get emails every day, my assistant gets emails every day that says, I love that talk. I'm not comfortable sending it to friends because the word shame is in it. And so I thought that's exactly why it's going to stay in there, because shame hates having words wrapped around it. If when we speak shame, we cut it off at the knees. The reason metaphors are so helpful is because of our reaction to the word shame. And here's the thing. If I talk to you intellectually about shame, I will lose you in about 10 minutes because you will know this is uncomfortable. It's a little bit dark and it's totally not relevant. I don't care what she's saying. It's true. If I intellectually talk to you about shame, if I walk you into shame, you'll be like, oh hell yeah, this is relevant. I cannot hear a word you are saying because I am in shame. Does that make sense? Because shame is all about the limbic system. It's all about fight, flight, and freeze. There's no prefrontal. So if I stay up here in your minds, I'm pointing to my forehead for those of y'all who are listening. If I'm right up here in the prefrontal cortex where we think and analyze and rationalize, then you will understand shame, but it won't mean jack. If I walk you into shame, even if I tell you a deeply shaming story for myself, one of my own stories, you'll get shame. But you will not be able to understand what we're talking about you because you'll be feeling it so powerfully. Because what happens is that when the limbic system, when that fight or flight response kicks in, our prefrontal cortex comes completely offline. Does that make sense? So my job is to talk about shame with you in a way that walks you into it so you're fully clear that I'm talking about, yes, you too. But this is not a place to, this is not the time or space to honor that work. So we can't all get into shame together. It sounds true. People are going, ixnay on bringing everyone into shame. Yeah. No, we can't do that. So we'll go back and forth, but metaphors are very helpful and gremlins are really helpful because shame drives two tapes. The two tapes that shame drives are never good enough. And who do you think you are? So I'm writing an article for O Magazine and I'm writing it and this is the shame gremlin. You're not good at this. Your writing sucks. No one cares. It's not interesting. You don't have your MFA. You're not a good writer. You're not enough. And so if I can talk that gremlin down, if I can say, hey, you know what? I'm writing this and I'm okay. Then what happens is the other side of shame, the other gremlin, is like a vice, comes in and says, ooh, who do you think you are? Look at you, Miss Too Big for Your Britches. That's the other side of shame. And so it really keeps us small and right in the middle of not good enough and who do you think you are? So for me, to talk about it like the gremlins and to talk about gremlins or shame tapes. And let me tell you about shame tapes. We all have them. Let me give you the 1, 2, 3 on shame that I do every time I talk about shame, just so people can breathe and pay attention. We all have it. I hope everyone in here has it. Because the only people who don't experience shame are people who have no capacity for empathy or connection. So the only people who don't experience shame are psychopaths, severe psychopathology. So we all have shame. Nobody wants to talk about it, and the less you talk about it, the more we have it. And so one of my goals in my life, really professionally for me, is to start a national conversation about shame. That's why when they invited me to Close TED this year, I said, I'm going to talk about shame. And they said, okay. Because we have to have this conversation. It cannot stand. The gremlins cannot stand to be spoken. The minute I call my friend and say, I cannot write this article. And she said, what are the gremlins? And the minute I say the gremlins are, I'm not smart enough and I'm a kind of crappy writer. The minute I say that, shame dissipates 80%. If it's met with empathy, not, oh my God, you're the totally best writer in the world, which is not empathic at all in code for total bullshit. It's the easy way out. Does saying that back to me require any vulnerability on the part of the person I'm talking to? No, here's empathy. Oh my God, I totally get that. I had to turn in a project last week. It was late because I sat on it because I was afraid to turn it in. That's empathy. You know, empathy is me too. You're not alone. So we have to speak shame. So the 1, 2, 3s, we all have it. No one wants to talk about it. The less we talk about it, the more we have it. To really understand shame, we have to understand the difference between shame and the other self-conscious affects or the self-conscious emotions. Shame, guilt, humiliation, and embarrassment. This is really important. Shame, I am bad. Guilt, I did something bad. And if you've heard me say this before, it's because I've said it every time I've ever talked about shame because there's no other way to explain it. Shame is a focus on self. Guilt is a focus on behavior. The simplest example I can give you is from an academic article that Rhonda Deering and June Tangney did on shame and addiction. You get to work late on a Friday because you're so hungover from getting drunk the night before on Thursday night. You're late enough on Friday that you miss a very important client meeting. And your self-talk is, I am such an idiot. I am a total loser. I'm a slacker. I'm a loser. Shame or guilt?
Shame.
Shame. Focus on self. I'm a loser. I'm an idiot. Same scenario, but you get to work and this time your self-talk is, I can't believe I did that. That was a really stupid thing to do. Shame or guilt?
Guilt.
The focus is on behavior, not self. So why is this important? This is critically, there's nothing, I'm not going to say anything more important than this in our time together, for sure. This is it. Because shame is highly, highly correlated with addiction, depression, suicide, bullying, aggression, violence, eating disorders. And if that doesn't get your attention enough, guilt is inversely correlated with those outcomes. Meaning the more guilt you're able to use and the more you're able to focus on behavior rather than self, the less likely it is that you'll experience those outcomes. In fact, shame and addiction are so intimately correlated, we don't even know where one starts and the other begins. We don't have a temporal understanding of it. You know, did you start self-medicating because you were full of shame, or are you full of shame because you're self-medicating? We don't even know. We just know it's the perfect storm. There's a great quote by Terrence Real, who wrote Men and the Myth of Male Depression. The title of the book is I Don't Want to Talk About It. He has some incredible work on marriage and partnerships. He has a quote that says, an addict needs shame like a man dying of thirst needs salt water. Isn't that powerful? Because think about it. Think about if I was, you know, if this was the ocean in front of me and I'm dying of thirst, how it would make so much sense that what I, you know, just drink. But it'll kill me, right? Shame kills people who are struggling with addiction. It's why often I think they're struggling with addiction. Guilt, as it turns out in the research, appears to be a protective factor against addiction. I mean, so if you're sitting in here and you're a parent, what you should be thinking, what I would, you know, that's why I'm trying to think of a better way, like no shoulds, but what I urge you to think, what I invite you to think, or what you should be thinking is, that's kind of Texas style for these talks. What you should be hell-bent for leather on thinking is this. Guilt, good. Guilt, productive. Guilt, adaptive. Shame, extremely dangerous. Extremely dangerous. Another way that I really like to drive this home is, if y'all did something, if you individually did something that hurt my feelings, let me see a show of hands. How many of you would be willing to apologize for making a mistake? So every hand goes up. That's guilt. Healthy, adaptive. Guilt is, I'm sorry, I made a mistake. Shame, I'm sorry, I am a mistake. a significant difference between shame and guilt. So what's interesting about this is that we can measure shame and guilt in people, even children. Tangney and Deering came up with an incredible instrument called the TSCA. It's a measurement of self-conscious affect. And it's a scenarios-based instrument that you go through scenarios and you pick how you would respond to something. I'm laughing because one of kind of the throwaway responses to make sure that it's a valid and reliable instrument is blame. And like, hi, my name's Brene. I'm a total blamer. I am a blamer. So let's talk about blame for a minute because it's important as we go into shame and guilt. Blame is simply defined in the research as the discharging of pain and discomfort. That's it. We blame when we're uncomfortable or when we're in pain. Right? So let me give you an example. My husband plays, this always needs a huge explanation, underwater hockey. He does. We're both ex-competitive swimmers. He's also an ex-competitive water polo player. And so a lot of those people play underwater hockey. If you're from California, you probably know what I'm talking about. It's actually, there's a puck and a stick and you're underwater. You're in an 11-foot water polo pool and the puck's on the bottom of the pool. And yeah, so he's going to practice. I know you're thinking, I see you shaking your head. Like, what the hell is she talking? Are there horses involved? No. Like you have fins and a mask. And you're under there shooting and you come up for breath as often as you need to and you try to get the puck in the other person's goal. It's a very endurance swimmer kind of fun sport, I guess. It's hell on the audience though, because anyway, it's like, it's 11 feet deep. So he plays underwater hockey. So he's going to go play underwater hockey one night and I said, make sure you're back by 10 because I'm really tired and I don't go to sleep well until he gets home. So the next morning, Steve's at work, the kids are at school, I'm home by myself, I'm drinking coffee, I'm getting ready to go teach at U of H, I have on white pants, pink cardigan, I remember exactly what I had on, and I've got a Pottery Barn mug full of coffee, and I drop it, and it hits the tile floor in my kitchen, coffee goes all over my pants, all over everything, it breaks into a million shards of glass, and my first response is, damn you, Steve. And this is the part where if you're here with a male partner, they'll feel quite vindicated during this story. So my first response is, damn you, Steve. Because here's my thought. He was late. I didn't go to bed until like 10:30. Ergo, my extra cup of coffee. And it's his fault that this happened. Because had he not come home, look, and you're shaking your head. Like, how many of you actually follow that train of thought and believe that's accurate? Okay. Right. For those of you listening and laughing, there's a lot of people who believe I'm right. In fact, it was 100%, including all the men. No. Okay. So that's my thinking. And like within a millisecond, I go from, damn it, Steve, because I'm uncomfortable and we blame to discharge anger, discomfort. That's all blame is. It has no adaptive function at all. And in fact, Steve called while I was cleaning up in my underwear because my white pants are off. And of course he calls and I'm like, hey, he said, what are you doing? Oh, I'm cleaning up coffee. What are you doing? He's like, cleaning up coffee. I'm like, yeah, I'm cleaning up coffee because I dropped coffee in the kitchen. And guess why I dropped coffee in the kitchen? And wait, all you hear is dial tone. He's like, no. Yeah, no. So blame is the discharging of discomfort. Okay, that's it. So when you take the TSCA, it has answers. So let me give you a scenario. One of the scenarios on the TSCA is that you're at a party. You're alone in a room. The hostess has white carpet and you drop your glass of red wine. Collective. Ooh. No one sees you. So do you? Eruptions of nervous laughter. You can tell the truth. It's just us and a couple thousand folks. Do you go find the hostess, offer to clean it up and pay for it if she can't get it up? Do you realize that no one sees you and kind of sneak out thinking, God, I'm such an idiot. I can't believe I did this. Or do you think, well, screw this. Who serves red wine when they have white carpet? Which is the blame scenario. So if you're being honest while you're taking this instrument, it's not like, it's not where you would eventually get to, because I am like a hyper accountable person. So like I would feel some kind of value and pride in going, I spilled red wine, I'm coming to tell you, you know, like, so I would ultimately do that. But my very first thought would be like, screw you for serving red wine. If you didn't want it on your white carpet. Well, and who gets white carpet? You know, that would, my blame would be my first thing. How many of you are blamers, honestly? Show of hands. My people. Okay. It's good. So in the Tosca, you can take this and we can tell based on, you know, how you answer these, whether you're shame prone or guilt prone. Or whether you use blame a lot. And they're kind of weeding that out of the Tosca, I think, as we speak. So we can measure that. And that's how we know about the correlations between violence, aggression, depression. I mean, some of the highest levels of shame proneness that we see are in violent criminals who are imprisoned, incarcerated. And so the important part about this is this. I always get questions, and more so even now than when I started 10 years ago, isn't shame a good compass for moral behavior? Shouldn't we feel ashamed? Let me tell you the big debate that's going on right now. The huge debate. In fact, there was a, what's the big paper in the UK, The Guardian? There was an article in The Guardian yesterday. I know because I have a shame Google alert. that basically said we should be publicly shaming obese people. Because, and then what the guy wrote in the article is someone, you know, he says, I was a fat slob until someone shamed me and then I got on a treadmill and lost weight, and that's what we should be doing because we shouldn't be footing the bill for people who are struggling with obesity. And if you have seen some of the national campaigns, national public health campaigns featuring obese children with taglines that say things like, it's fun to be a little girl, but I'm not so little, or no starts in the buffet line and at home. And so there is a huge debate in our culture right now about whether we should be using shame to deal with public health issues. And the answer is no. I don't care how good it makes us feel. I don't care if we see someone that commits some kind of atrocity against the public or hurts someone and it feels good to see them shamed and belittled. Good. That's good. That's the dark side of human nature. There's nothing we can do about that. What I'm telling you, as a researcher and 50 years of data, not just mine, there is not a single drop of empirical evidence that shows us that shame is a good way to change behavior. You shame someone for their behavior, what do you think they do? They engage in it even more. What do you think? You shame me about my weight. What do you think I'm going to be doing? I'm going to be visiting Ben and Jerry. You know, I'm going to be in my pantry with a tub of peanut butter. What do we see happening right now in the culture? The mommy wars. Right? Let me just give you this very exacting opinion from me. You cannot claim to care about children and shame mothers for the choices they're making. Period. Period. If you want to breastfeed your kids until they're six, right on. You do it. But if while you're doing that, you're shaming mothers who are bottle feeding their newborns, that's not helpful. And if you want to bottle feed your newborn and then, you know, call moms who are breastfeeding until their kids are, you know, older, hippies and weirdos, you can. But you're shaming people and you're going to be raising judgmental children. You know, that's just the evidence. Does that make sense? Okay. Look, I got kind of sweaty talking about that. Very important. So shame and guilt, hugely different. Shame does not move behavior forward. It is not a catalyst for meaningful, lasting change. Guilt is. Guilt is adaptive. Guilt is cognitive dissonance. Guilt is holding something we've done up against who we want to be. And it's uncomfortable. And that's okay. But guilt is not about who we are, it's about behavior. Does that make sense? Humiliation. There's only one variable that separates humiliation from shame, and it's the variable of deserving. So, I used to use someone from the audience, but I don't use anyone from the audience anymore, because 85% of men and women that we've interviewed 85% remember something so shaming that happened in school that it forever changed how they thought of themselves as learners. 85%. Of those 85%, this is to me what's shocking, about half of those were creativity scars. Were around writing, art, performing. And we wonder why there's a creativity and innovation crisis on the front of Time magazine. You know, when that would make it something like 40% of adults can remember something so shaming around creativity that happened that it changed how they thought of themselves. I'm going to give you a real example, and we're going to say that I'm a teacher in a classroom, and I've just handed back papers. I've got one paper left, and it doesn't have a name on it. Who didn't get a paper? Who did not get a paper? Susie? Oh, Susie, you did not get a paper. How many of you are surprised that Susie didn't get a paper? This is a real example from the research. I'm asking a question. I said, how many people are surprised that Susie did not get a paper? Let me just tell you, FYI, I'm coming out of role play here. The only place where people will just pound on Susie are when I do this lecture in medical schools. They're like, we knew she wouldn't get a paper. Because the environment is so conducive to competition and shame that they're like, we throw you under the bus in a heartbeat. So teacher walks up, Susie, this is a fourth grade classroom. Susie, let me tell you what I'm going to do. No name on your paper. I'm going to help you out. S-T-U-P-I-D. Stupid. So here's what we know. We know that Susie is going to experience this as shame or humiliation. I mean, Susie has a capacity to feel, which we are assuming she does. She's going to experience this as humiliation. Here's the difference. If Susie's self-talk is, that is the rotten, nastiest, most horrible teacher ever, I did not deserve that. That's humiliation. If Susie's self-talk is, God, I'm so stupid. I'm so stupid. Why'd I do that? I'm so stupid. What is that? Here's why shame is so much more detrimental than humiliation. Because if Susie experiences that as humiliation, there's normally a little side dose of pissed offness that comes with humiliation. Because the variable is I didn't deserve it. Deserving is a separating variable, right? So the chances of me hearing about this as a parent or a caregiver are very high. But if Susie experiences this as a shame, the chances of me hearing about it are zero. Because there's no news. I'm stupid. I got called stupid. Does that make sense? So what I often tell parents is that it's not enough to make a commitment to not use shame when you parent. You have to teach kids shame resilience. Like in our house, we have a very clear rule. Zero name calling. Zero. I don't care if you burn down the school. There will be consequences because we're actually pretty strict parents. I mean, we're from Texas. So yeah, we're strict. We don't yell or scream or any of that stuff, but we hold our kids accountable a lot because we think it's important. And there would be consequences, natural consequences from doing something, but under no circumstances is name calling okay. Which means that Steve and I can't call each other names when we're mad at each other. Which means I keep a very close eye on the sibling relationship between my kids. Siblings are often a huge source of shame and often very dismissed by parents. Boys will be boys. Oh, they're just normal. But I have to tell you that when I interview adults who have disrupted relationships with their adult siblings, because there was a lot of cruelty, physical stuff, the anger and the grief is pointed at the parents. The grief is, why did they let us talk to each other this way? The sibling relationship is a very important, sacred relationship that I think parents have an obligation to cultivate. And one of the ways they do that is no name calling, because the thing is that siblings know the gremlins probably better than most other people. So if Susie's staying at the window, if Susie's 16 and staying at the window 45 minutes after her date was supposed to pick her up, it's easy for Bobby, the 13-year-old brother, to say, lose 10 pounds, Susie, maybe he'll come by, or, you know, get that acne cleared up, or whatever that thing is that is, you know, her demon, her gremlin. And that has to be unacceptable. The conversation in our house would sound something like, we can't talk to each other like that in this house. And if you're mad at your sister about something, we can talk about that. But you can't talk to her like that. I would never allow anyone to talk to you like that. This is a safe place for us. That's not going to happen here. That also means no name calling, self name calling. That means when my daughter's struggling with her homework or Charlie's frustrated with piano, no, I'm so dumb, I don't get it, or I'm so stupid. Which means we also can't talk to ourselves that way. Because if Ellen spills something and she goes, God, I'm so stupid. And I say, sweetie, you're not stupid. You spilled something. It's an accident. That's great. That's like right out of the shame parenting handbook. You know, A+. But if she walks into the kitchen 5 minutes later and I've dropped my Diet Coke and I'm saying, God, I'm so stupid. Which do you think counts? Or if I'm saying, damn you, Steve. Right. What's the message there? The message is there's always someone to blame. Yeah, I hate to like get incredibly philosophical and highbrow on you, but the bumper sticker shit happens has some meaning. It means something. Bad stuff happen. And the funny thing about blamers, I think too, myself included, is we'd even rather be at blame than no one to be at blame. Does that make sense? Like I get a flat tire and my first thought is, if I was in better shape, I wouldn't have gotten a flat tire. So this just happened. Because skinny people who work out a lot always like do the maintenance checks and they do all that stuff on time. And, you know, they go right from the elliptical to the tire store and they're very organized. Like that's my thinking. But that's shaming, right? And here's the great story. Because so what happens? You lose the 10 pounds or you do whatever you want to do and you still get a flat tire. Then you're like what? Smart people. Rich people, whatever the other people are. Okay, so we've got shame, guilt, humiliation, and the last self-conscious affect is embarrassment. Embarrassment is the least significant in terms of emotional power. Fleeting, often funny, but the hallmark of embarrassment is if you do something embarrassing, you're pretty sure you're not the only one that's ever done it. Whereas shame makes you feel really alone. If you do something embarrassing, you know, I do embarrassing things all the time. So I kind of had a flutter of embarrassment when I got to my hotel yesterday because anyone else fly in yesterday around 2:00? Okay, God, I am a horrible flyer. I'm very nervous. I think I've cheated death every time I land. And it was bumpy, like the kind where the overhead doors were coming open and the flight attendants were seated. And so there was a guy sitting next to me and I was saying the serenity prayer over and over and over, you know, and I was like, I have control over nothing. I'm not serene. And so I said, what can I control? What can I control? And so I tapped him and can you talk to me for a few minutes? And he said, about what? And I said, I'm just having a really hard time. I am fearful that we're going to crash because, and he's like, yeah, it's really bumpy. And I said, well, can you just talk to me? He's like, about what? And I'm like, I don't know. What's your favorite dessert? And so I played this game. Like, what's your favorite dessert? What's your favorite food? What food do you hate to eat? And we did it for like 10 minutes. And by then we were on the ground. And so I was like, I hope he didn't recognize me. Like my whole big fear is like Twitter, like Brene Brown, insane on plane, you know, But I had that embarrassment, you know, that flutter, I guess that's the word I was looking for, that flutter of, God, did I really do that? But I only played it back once and I thought, you know what? Everybody does weird things when they think they're going to die, you know, like, and I did think I it's my last trip of the season. So I'm like, this is the big one. So embarrassment's fleeting and it's funny. I can tell it to you now. I can tell you this for sure. If something shaming happened yesterday, I would not be telling you that story today. Does that make sense? So fleeting, funny. And the hallmark is we know we're not alone. So we've got guilt, shame, humiliation, embarrassment. Here's the tricky part of understanding how these work. This is especially true for mental health professionals, but also for parents and partners and anyone engaged in a relationship. What is shaming for me may bring up guilt in you, humiliation for you, slightly embarrassing for you and may not even come up on your radar. Does that make sense? Shame is a very individualized, contextualized experience. Going back really primarily to family of origin issues. What did we hear growing up? And so one of the things I want to talk about is the role of story and shame. One of the things I've come to believe about shame is about the power of owning our stories. When it comes to shame, we have two options, and that is we either walk into the stories of our lives and we own them, or we stand outside our stories and we hustle for our worthiness. Because what happens is our worthiness lives inside of our story. And everyone in here, myself included, have orphaned some of our stories that don't fit with who we think we're supposed to be. And the problem is that orphaning stories and not owning them gives shame extraordinary power. And so I think the key to shame resilience is about walking into our stories and owning them. The thing about wholeheartedness is, remember when I said that wholehearted men and women believe they're worthy of love and belonging? Worthiness has no prerequisites. So a lot of people will say, well, I mean, kind of worthy of love and belonging, but I'll be really worthy of love and belonging if I make partner, if my wife's not really cheating, if my kid gets into Stanford, if I get promoted, if I stay sober, if I lose 20 pounds. We have this litany of prerequisites for worthiness. And those prerequisites for worthiness are the shame gremlins. Those are our shame triggers. If you want to know what are the shame triggers, you have to ask yourself, what are the prerequisites for worthiness? And the way most of us get those prerequisites is they're handed down to us from our families of origin. And we definitely pick up a few on the way. I'm often asked by the Jungian people, can you have a shame trigger that's not a family of origin wound? And the answer is absolutely, because look at our culture. Yeah, I don't care how you raise your daughters and sons. We have far less control over the media influence than we'd like to have. You know, you can tell your kids every day that they're great and they're beautiful and their bodies are perfect. But, you know, there's a great quote that says, keeping kids safe from the media culture is like asking them not to breathe to keep them safe from air pollution. You know, it's like it is, and it just soaks in our DNA and it becomes part of who we are. So I don't think all of the gremlins are from family of origin, but it's certainly a starting point. So as you're doing this exploration in your own life, I would ask, what are the prerequisites for worthiness? And it's interesting, I heard some of the really big universal ones earlier when I asked about play. When I said, what keeps us from playing? And I heard one of the most universal shame triggers or gremlins, lazy. Like that's a huge shame trigger for me. Oh, it's horrible shame trigger for me. I mean, again, it's not only fifth generation Texan, but German American. Like we don't get sick. We don't miss work. We are the head of suck it up, soldier on, push through, get her done. And the interesting thing about shame triggers is that, and Stephen, my producer, and I had a long talk about this when we were recording one of the CDs, The Men, Women, and Worthiness. There are those moments like Susie had in school, where the teacher walked up and wrote stupid, where all of us can reach back into our lives, right? And think, I can remember this moment. I remember how the shame trigger got planted. I remember when this gremlin was birthed. I can't point to lazy. I don't know that I was ever called lazy by anybody in my house growing up. And let me tell you, right along with lazy is sick. Sick is a shame trigger for me. Like I do not do sick well at all. Because it's part of the same vibe in our house. I don't think I was ever put down or made fun of or ridiculed or shamed for being sick. But let me tell you what I saw growing up. What I saw growing up is that my parents never stopped. I saw my mom have surgery on Thursday, and Friday morning she was driving carpool, running the Brownies meeting, dropping off, and she was the swim team starter at the swim meet Saturday morning. You know, I never saw my parents stop, rest, self-care. They just went. And they even took care of like sick relatives or sick people. My parents were the first there with the casserole. But I also saw, and I've talked to my parents about this, otherwise I wouldn't be sharing it with you. I also saw a lot of self-loathing if they got sick. Like they were disgusted by their own having to stop, you know, or slow down. So one of the things we have to be careful of is there are not always moments that we can track back to that, oh, this is where this happened. This is where this message came in. but it's also just part of the values that we saw acted out in our families. Does that make sense? Because some of those are stories. And like for me, I got pregnant. I tried to get pregnant and got pregnant successfully, thankfully, during my doctoral program. And when I went back to school, and I think I was maybe 8 weeks very early, and told some of my professors and my mentors, the first comment I heard back was, "We really thought you were going to be somebody." Wow. Right. So I was just devastated. Because my husband was in residency, and you know, when you're having that kind of long education, and while I was getting my PhD, you don't stop your life. You know, you just have it and figure it out. And so I became really convinced that the best way to do this was to show what a badass I could be while I was pregnant and a doctoral student. Like I would take on more work and I would even be better and smarter and, you know, do everything like the bionic pregnant woman, smarter, faster, better. I got hyperemesis. So for those of you who don't know who that is, it's like severe illness your first trimester. It's not morning sickness. It's like you have a huge amount of progesterone, I think is what it is. So much that you rarely have miscarriages because progesterone is a protective factor, but you are sick. I mean, I was 18 pounds in my first trimester. I lost. I couldn't hold down ice cubes. I had to go into intensive care to get fluids and electrolytes. Like, you're sick. So I had to take a leave of absence. So can you imagine on top of that, we thought you were going to be somebody. So I remember checking into the hospital and still, and I was sick, really sick. And I was like, "Do you have Wi-Fi?" And my husband was so mad. And he was like, "No, they don't have it. You're in a hospital. You are sick, like dangerously sick." And I'm like, "Well, what I need to do is I need to get a TA to bring me all my papers so I can, because I was teaching too, grade them and da-da-da-da." And I remember him taking me by the face and saying, "You're sick. Dangerously sick. And there will be no Wi-Fi and there'll be no teaching and there'll be no grading because you're sick." And I remember saying back in total sincerity, "I don't get sick." And my husband's a pediatrician, you know, so he's like, "You do get sick and you are sick and you will not finish out the semester, your courses, the ones you're teaching or taking. You're done." And so my parents came to visit. And I had this long conversation with them about, how did this happen? How did I get to 33 thinking that I don't ever get sick? And it was this really powerful healing conversation of, this is how you were raised. And our parents taught us this and we taught you this. And this was the message, that weak people get sick, that lazy people stop and rest. And again, it was never explicit for me. And so when you're thinking about these things that you've orphaned, or you're thinking about these parts of yourselves, that's why, you know, Ellen, my husband's a believer as a pediatrician that you get a finite number of illnesses between zero and the end of kindergarten. And you can either get them all in kindergarten if you stay at home, or you can get them spread out over time, but you're going to get sick like X number of times. It's happening. Well, Ellen got sick and missed school 10 times during kindergarten. And I remember time number three, I was like, I remember looking at her and going, "I think you're good." And she was like, you know, and I look up and I see Steve and I'm like, oh my God. He's like, "Back out of the room." And I'm a loving mom. I mean, I'm pretty proud of the way I parent. I mean, I'm imperfect. I make tons of mistakes. Ergo, "I think you're good." But without awareness, it's really difficult. Does that make sense? Okay. So let's talk about shame resilience. Do you think y'all are all clear on what shame is and how it works, where it comes from? The gremlins, alive and well? Okay. Let's talk about shame resilience and unpack empathy. Empathy is the antidote to shame. So here's the great news. Men and women with high levels of shame resilience share four things in common across the data. Every single time. Here are the elements of shame resilience. Number one, they know what shame is and they know what triggered it. Meaning they know when they're in it and they know why they're in it. They can name their gremlins. Number two, this is a really big one. They can reality check or practice critical awareness around the expectations and messages that send shame. For example, with my story, the message and expectation, I have to reality check that. I do get sick. I'm human. I'm vulnerable. And the last two we've already been talking about a little bit, and that is reaching out, telling our story, and speaking shame. It's not like an academic linguistic pet peeve that you use the word shame for shame. It's just that men and women who have high levels of shame resilience, not because I train them, but when they came to me, they use the word shame. If I called any of you and I said, and let's say you're really busy, and you're in the middle of something really important at work, and you see my name on your cell phone and you pick it up and you're like, hey, what's going on? And I'm like, oh my God, you're not going to believe I'm so embarrassed about something that happened at work. The chances are that you would say, hey, I'm right in the middle of something. Let me call you back. I want to hear all about it. Right? If I called and you picked up the phone and I said, hey, I'm in some deep shame about something at work, that would be a completely different thing for you, right? That might be, what do you need right now? I can't talk to you for another 15 minutes. Promise me you'll answer the phone. Or screw what I'm doing. I need to talk to her. People who have high levels of shame resilience call shame, shame. They call guilt, guilt. They call embarrassment, embarrassment. And they call humiliation, humiliation. It's really important that we identify and understand those emotions and don't get them confused. So again, the elements of shame resilience. We know what shame is and we know when we're in it and what triggered it. We reality check the messages and expectations that fuel it. We reach out, we tell our story, and we speak shame. So one of the things that's important about knowing that you're in shame is this. Remember we talked about the prefrontal cortex and the limbic system? Men and women with high levels of shame resilience know when they're in shame. Here's why. When we're in shame, we are not fit for human consumption. We normally, if we're around another person, will engage in a behavior that exacerbates shame. So I turned what people know who have high levels of shame resilience into questions for those of us to answer who want shame resilience. What are your physical symptoms of shame? Say it.
Gut.
What does your gut do?
Tight.
Face flushes, turns red. Choked up. I'm going to cry. Palms tingle.
Small.
Inability to hold a gaze. Okay. So do you know what you just described? Trauma symptoms. It's the exact same if you were in Afghanistan right now and something traumatic happened. If you were on the highway and had to slam on your brakes because you were getting ready to go into an accident. These are trauma symptoms. We experience shame as trauma. Shame is traumatic. And so men and women with high levels of shame resilience know they're in shame. For me, time slows down, my mouth gets dry, I get tunnel vision, and my armpits tingle. It's exactly what would happen to me if I had to slam on my brakes and my kids were in the car or I was looking up and there was a wreck right in front of me. Because it hijacks the limbic system. Why? Shame is trauma because for us when we're small, I mean, now, shame is the threat of being unlovable. The definition of shame is the extremely painful belief or experience of thinking that we are unlovable, that we are unworthy of connection and belonging. So from the time that we're born through mid-elementary school, to be unlovable is a threat to survival. You don't love me. You don't feed me. You don't provide shelter. You don't provide caring. So shame is crazy making. It's not like we go into shame and then we think, oh, I have a warm wash of inadequacy coming over me. I feel small and unlovable. Yet I know that's not true. Yeah, that's not how shame works. You know, I come out swinging when I'm in shame. You know, and so one of the reasons we know, I mean, perfect story that I tell often is from the, it's in I Thought It Was Just Me, one of the early research interviews. A woman goes, fills her car up with gas, goes inside a filling station, pays, her credit card is declined. The guy makes her leave her wallet and her wedding ring and just leave with an ATM card to go get money from an ATM machine. She gets in the car. She slams the door. Her three-year-old's in the back seat, asleep in the car seat. He wakes up and starts crying. What do you think happens? She starts screaming, for she said the next 5 miles, shut up, just shut the fuck up. She said she had never even cursed in front of her kids. She said, I had no idea what was wrong with me. All I knew in that second was not only am I a loser, white trash person that has no money on my credit card, but I'm a crappy mom too. We have a tendency to engage in behaviors that exacerbate shame when we're in shame. And the people who are most vulnerable are the people around us that have less power than us. How many of you have ever seen that play out at work? When your boss or someone gets shamed and they just discharge right on whoever's next to them. We're dangerous in shame. We need to get back on our emotional feet before we engage with the world. So you need to figure out, my invitation for you is to figure out when you're in shame, what do you need to get back on your feet? I have to be alone. It will take at least 15 minutes and I will cry before it's over. For sure. I have walked out of faculty meetings, group therapy when I was facilitating it. Yes, which is why I always recommend that you have a co-facilitator. Because let me tell you, are there any mental health professionals in the room? Yeah, let me tell you something. Let me tell you how shame works for all of you mental health professionals. Let me tell you why the little outcome data we have shows that clinical interventions around shame are more likely to exacerbate shame than to heal it. Meaning the outcome data that we have say that we made your shame worse when you come see us. Because let me tell you how shame works in the clinical situation. You're with me and you're the client and I'm the therapist and you come in and shame comes into the room with you. You tell a shaming story. Here's what shame does. It drops to the floor, goes across the carpet and up my leg and around my neck. All shame has to do to bring down a therapeutic healing process is bring down the practitioner. So the bottom line doing shame work for mental health professionals is you got to do this work to do this work. You got to be really clear on what shame is for you because it is one of the most contagious affects we experience. So shame is very contagious. So when I say I've walked out of a room, I really did have to walk out of a room. I was so deep in shame from this woman's story that I just knew that, and we came back and processed it. I've walked out of a one-on-one meeting with my boss and said, I'm going to need to reschedule. This is not productive. I've got that memorized. I'm going to need to reschedule. This is not productive. I'm going to need to reschedule. This is not productive. It's the only thing. Like my shame thing is don't say anything, text anything, email anything. I'm going to need to reschedule. This is not productive. That's so I do. Because I'm going to come out swinging. The Stone Center is great. Wellesley, they have Linda Hartling led a group of researchers to look at the ways we respond to shame. And they came up with three. You know, Freud had the defense mechanisms, right? They took those, and it's kind of Karen Horney's work, where they said, we our three responses to shame, this is really important for you to think about in your own lives, is we move away, we move toward, or we move against. So moving away is something shaming happens, and we silence ourselves, and we secret keep. Moving toward is we people please. And moving against is we use shame to fight shame. So before we break from the session, I'll tell this quick story because I think it's very illustrative. I, very early on, and probably maybe, well, Charlie's going to be 7, so it was 6 years ago, I was teaching a class on global justice with Jody Williams, who is the Nobel Peace Prize winner. She was the head of the campaign to ban landmines. Jody got together with all the other living female laureates to create the Nobel Women's Initiative, where they shine a light, they kind of use their Nobelness to shine a light on women activists on the ground. They put together a board, and I was asked to be on this board, and the meetings were in L.A. And I'd have to be gone a week, which is, it's the longest I've ever been away since, and up until this point. And I had a 6-month-old at the time. And so I really was torn about what to do until Steve finally said, you're going. This is your work, this is important, you should do it, it's great, I got it. So the Monday after I came back, I was in carpool line and a woman came up to my window. And every time I've had a conversation with this woman, I left feeling slimed. She was tough on me, I felt, every time we had a conversation. So she comes up and I'm in carpool line. I make the mistake of rolling down my window and she says, where have you been? And so my authenticity mantra is don't puff up, don't shrink. stand your sacred ground. So to not puff up meant, I've been changing the world. What have you been doing? You know, like, don't puff up. Like, you know, don't puff up. You know, if you're ever around me and I lead with Dr. Brené Brown, be like, oh, shame gremlins are out. You know, like, right. So I just said, oh, I was away on business. And she said, you were gone the whole week. This is Texas, so you have to understand. So I said, I was. She said, who took care of those kids? And I said, well, my mom took off a couple days and she took care of them. And then my mother-in-law came in for a couple days and then Steve took a day off. She says, he's so sweet to raise those kids while you're gone. And I was like, right after he impregnated me and, you know, yeah, they're his kids. Yeah. So I didn't say that, but I'm thinking that. So let me be clear about what I said. So I'm like, yeah. And she said, but this is like, this is, if you hear this in Texas, you have been just slimed. Bless your heart. That means you're fixing to get nailed and God's on that person's side. So she, bless your heart. It's got to be so hard to be on the road and let other people raise those kids for you. So immediately my armpits tingle. I go into tunnel vision, you know, and so my mantra, this is not productive. I've got to reschedule. I've got to do something, you know. But this is actually what I did. This is from a woman named Caroline, who I interviewed like 4 years ago. She told me to practice shame resilience. Whenever she was in shame, she would go like this. Pain, 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 pain. And she said, I know it's crazy. And I'm like, it is not crazy. It is brilliant. It is neurobiologically brilliant. Because what do you think she's doing when she does that? What do you think happens? She's getting her prefrontal cortex back online, right? So she's coming out of like lizard brain. So I was like, hey, 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 hey. So I just said, I better pull up because I was in carpal line. I better pull up. And I rolled up the window and the person in front of me had not moved an inch. And she's still standing outside my window. And so I just go. Okay, so let's talk about these three ways we can do this. Moving away. I could have, and I've done this many times in my life, I could have moved away. I could have disappeared in my own community, slithered in to pick up my kids from school, slithered home, not answered calls, just disappeared. How many of you disappear when you're in shame? Okay, I could have disappeared. I used to think it was a more benign way of handling shame, but let me tell you, when you disappear on people, it pisses them off. It worries them, and then it pisses them off. And then you have to be like, well, there was a big story, but there's not really a story. So disappearing is not benign. The second thing I could have done is I could have people-pleased. I could have looked at her and I could have said, you know what? I wish I was a mom like you. You're so awesome. Which I've done 100 times. Then you risk vomiting in your own mouth. No, like, no, you do. You risk being disappointed with yourself, right? Because that's not authentic. Shame resilience is all about maintaining authenticity and moving through shame. Or move against. I could have looked at her and said, have you seen your kids in school? You should let someone raise them for a week. Which is really, I know y'all are thinking she's terrible, but that's really where I would go because I'm quick on my feet. How many of you would go there? Yeah. Again, my people. I hope you're the blamers too because we've got a lot in common. But the thing is, think about this. If the goal of shame resilience is awesome because here's what shame resilient people have that a lot of us don't. They move through shame, maintain their authenticity, and move through that process and come out the other side of it with more courage, compassion, and connection than they had before the event. So what I did, I picked up Ellen, went home. I didn't say anything. Got Ellen started on her homework and got her a snack, got my cordless phone, went into my closet and started crying and called my best friend. And said, this is what just happened. And she's like, do I need to really tell you that you're a good mom and it's okay that you were in LA for 5 days? I'm like, you absolutely need to tell me that. She goes, I can tell you that. And we talked about it and we ended up laughing, which is a weird kind of important part of shame resilience. I call it knowing laughter. Even my friends who do like incest survivor groups around shame will say that laughter is a very important measure. And it's not laughter as defense or self-deprecation. It's that, oh my God, I'm not the only one. Do you know what I mean? The power of that. So shame resilience is empathy. It's about reaching out, telling our stories with someone who's earned the right to hear them, with someone who can meet us with empathy, who can look at us and say, I get it. Me too. I understand. It's about choosing those people carefully Because you don't want to share a story with someone and that story is right up in their shame grill. Do you know what I mean? Because that, then they can come back and like, oh my God, you did what? And that's not helpful. But shame resilience is about moving through.